Sometimes in Canadian media, you might not be hearing the whole story. Wow, that's better. When you support independent Canadian media, you can listen to all kinds of perspectives. Support Rabble.ca and independent media by going to rabble.ca/donate.
This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
Rabble.ca.
You're listening to Rabble Book Lounge, a production of Rabble.ca. I'm Braden Alexander, associate producer of the Rabble Podcast Network. In this episode, Octopus Books in Ottawa, Ontario, saw the launch of a book focusing on the increasing presence of Canadian mining companies in Central and South America. Blood of Extraction, written by Todd Gordon and Jeffrey R. Weber, looks at the impact upon the environment and human rights, and the growing opposition to Canadian resource extraction in Latin America. Todd Gordon spoke about the new book and provided some context between the voices in the resistance movement and the efforts by mining organizations to silence those voices.
The starting point of Imperialist Canada and Blood of Extraction is that Canada is an imperialist country. Obviously, it's got a long legacy of settler colonialism, and that's something that I try to connect in Imperialist Canada. And building on that in the context of Canada's engagement in Latin America. And so a long legacy of settler colonialism and a growing legacy in terms of its relationship with the global south, and again, in particular, in Latin America. And obviously, to refer to Canada as imperialist is not something that you see quite as often in, certainly in popular discourse, as well as academic discourse. I think that's changing, but I'd be curious to know what people think of that. It's probably still to a certain degree going against the grain, despite the fact that Canada is a G8 nation. It's one of the richest countries in the world. It has extensive foreign investment interests globally. It's one of the largest military spenders globally, even though it's not even close, of course, to the United States or China. But it's still one of the major military spenders globally. It's had, by my count, 5 major military interventions in the last decade or so. And there's increasing resistance to Canadian companies, directly to Canadian companies and Canadian state practices globally. But despite that, to a certain degree, I think maybe, it's going against the grain to try to make the argument that Canada is imperialist. But that's certainly what's partly driving this research project. So in terms of some of the research for the book, there's 2 sections to the book. The first section is a kind of introductory where we try to lay out the argument for why we think Canada's imperialist, and drawing on the works of thinkers like David Harvey, theory of accumulation by dispossession, which is building on Karl Marx's idea of primitive accumulation, that is that capitalism in general is based on the dispossession of people, land-based peoples, and while that was certainly key to understand the origins of capitalism, as Marx argued, as David Harvey and many other people have argued, it's actually not something that simply ends once capitalism gets consolidated in England, and certainly in the Canadian case, not something that ends when capitalism gets consolidated in the Canadian context through settler colonialism, but it's a process that's ongoing. As capital expands globally, as it goes through new phases of accumulation, of the pursuit of wealth, that there's a process that's always been a part of it, which engages through state practices, through corporate practices, of dispossessing people from their land and resources in order to access those resources, and in some cases, to access the labor of people who are then dispossessed from the land. The first section is trying to lay out how Canada fits into that global system. Canada's not a superpower. It's not the United States. It's not China. But the fact that it's not a superpower doesn't itself negate the fact that Canada, as I've argued, has significant interests, corporate interests, Canadian-owned corporate interests in the global south, and that there are people in the global south who are resisting those interests. And so even though Canada's not a superpower and it doesn't have the capacity to project political or military power in the same way the United States does, doesn't mean that Canada doesn't have those interests and doesn't have the capacity to, in certain degrees, project its political power, sometimes on its own, sometimes in alliance with the United States. So just because you're not a superpower doesn't mean that you aren't an imperialist country. And so I'm trying to, or Jeff and I are trying to challenge that idea, that there isn't just one imperial power in the world. There's a hierarchy in the world system. And there's some at the very, very top, but there's some that are close to the top, even if they're not at the top. And that's where we would situate Canada in terms of its foreign interests. The other two sections of the book, we take up particular regions of Latin America. So one section takes up Central America with a fairly focused chapter in Honduras and a fairly focused chapter on Guatemala, and then a third chapter on security more generally in Central America and looking at El Salvador, Panama, and Costa Rica. And then the final section of the book looks at the Andean region. We've got chapters on Ecuador, Peru, Colombia, and Venezuela. The book involves a fair bit of field research. Jeff and I both spent some time in Honduras. I spent a bit of time in Guatemala, and Jeff spent a fair bit of time as well in Venezuela and Ecuador, where we interviewed social movement activists, people who are organizing campaigns directly against Canadian mining companies, people who are organizing campaigns against Canadian sweatshop companies. We interviewed government officials in certain cases, like in Ecuador, where Jeff managed to interview people who are ex-members of the Rafael Correa government, who split from the government or were booted out of the government from a critical perspective. In Honduras, we interviewed anti-coup activists. There's a coup in Honduras, a military coup in 2009, which both Canada and the United States supported in different ways that we discuss in detail in the book. And so we met a lot of anti-coup activists, people who are in mining, people who are in the media, indigenous activists. One of the persons that we interviewed, you might have heard her name, Berta Caceres, was murdered last winter. We had the fortunate to have an opportunity to speak with her. She's a very inspiring activist. And then other people we interviewed, including a journalist, have been assaulted and threatened and so on. And so we based a lot of our research on what people in the region are actually saying about what Canada is actually doing, and then tying that to empirical study of Canadian foreign investment using Statistics Canada data, looking at the extent to which Canadian companies, particularly in mining, but also in banking and in sweatshop manufacturing, are actually invested throughout the region. And then another key component of the research is a kind of an archival component where we look through access to information documents, or documents that we got through access to information. And some people in this room I know have done some of that research. And it's a really unpleasant thing to do. It's very arduous. The governments and various ministries find all sorts of ways to slow the process down. I mean, it's not very well funded, but to give you all sorts of surplus documents and then to redact so much from it, but we had really over thousands of pages of documents, right? And there's no smoking gun in it, but what you can do from the information that you can get that's not redacted is you read through those thousands of pages, you actually get a lot of interesting information. It's one part of the puzzle. The other part being the interviews with the activists in the region and the empirical data on foreign investment and so on, and using some newspaper sources and other primary sources from the region as well. But what you find from these documents, from the access documents, is just how closely tied Canadian government is to Canadian multinational corporations and how actively they're supporting Canadian companies in the region and coming up with strategies to undermine opposition to Canadian foreign investment in the region, whether that's opposition from social movement activists or whether it's opposition from local government officials who either are opposed to Canadian interests or are kind of on the fence or are potentially swayed by local community activists. What you see is an extremely, extremely aggressive foreign policy orientation on the ground, the boots on the ground, if you will. And that's not just from foreign affairs. It's certainly from foreign affairs, but it's also from CETA, as we got documents from CETA. But it's also, as you discover, you're reading through foreign affairs documents, you see actually how they're working with Natural Resources Canada in these many instances, or how they're working with Health Canada, actually, or how they're working with Indigenous and Northern Affairs, getting Indigenous Northern Affairs to go down, sending people from INAC down to the region to speak to Indigenous communities, or to get Indigenous people from Canada who support Canadian mining to go down and present their interests to Latin American indigenous activists. And one document we found describes the language that they use for as a slides of a presentation that they gave is Canadian indigenous people, the first miners in Canada or something like that effect. You know? They don't really leave out the fact that they're not doing large-scale industrial mining. It's actually something quite different. But you get the point that I'm making. And so it's interesting, when you see all these documents, it's very painful to read it, very frustrating to read it. But what you do see is just how deeply, deeply enmeshed in what's going on, often behind the scenes. Also, the informal linkages, too, between the Canadian mining or banking companies or sweatshop manufacturing companies and Canadian government officials, embassy officials, diplomats, and so on, is where there's just this casual kind of, because a lot of it is also done off the record, so there's references to going for coffee, going for juice, or breakfast, or we're going to sit down, we're going to have this discussion with some government officials in Ecuador, so let's meet at such and such a time, talk about that. It's just really, there's a deep, deep penetration that unless you see a lot of this, and some people in this room probably have, and the folks from Mining Watch would have, it's hard to grasp the extent of it, but it is very significant. And so that was a key part of our research. The sectors in which Canadian companies are increasingly active, as you might imagine, are mining, but it's not just mining. Mining is resource extraction more generally, of course, is the most important, but it's also banking, financial interests, which are often tied to mining interests. So for example, Scotiabank would be perhaps one of the more prominent ones, generates more than one-fifth of its profits from its international investments, the majority of which are in the Americas. And from 2007 to 2012, Scotiabank spent $6 billion on more than 20 acquisitions in the Americas. And if you look at what they're actually saying, so for example, an interview done with the former CEO of Scotiabank when they bought up a Colombian bank, they're actually quite explicit about it. The reason why we're buying this bank is because Canada and the United States just signed a free trade agreement with Colombia. There's opportunity, huge opportunity to grow, to help finance the project and make a lot of money. And it's not an accident that Canadian banks are significantly involved in the region. And in the English-speaking Caribbean, which is home of a lot of offshore financial centers, Canadian banks are the dominant players in the region. They are the most important financial capital in the region. They're the biggest banks. And what's interesting about that is this offshore financial center. So that money is not just staying there. It's actually being rerouted through there as a tax haven that then goes into foreign direct investment in different countries in Latin America. So, for example, you'll find embassy officials who will say that the data on Canadian foreign direct investment in different countries in Latin America that you get from the Canadian government is actually low. And the reason it's low, because they're not counting the money that's being routed through offshore financial centers. So the data is actually quite strong. Like, if you just look at the data that's provided by Statistics Canada on foreign investment, it's actually quite high, very, very high. But it's actually not capturing it all. It's not capturing what's going through the offshore financial centers into Latin America. And so despite that, Canada from 2007 to 2012 was the second largest external foreign investor in Latin America behind the United States. And of course, it's not nearly as great as the United States in that regard in terms of absolute numbers. But if you actually control for size of the economy, Canada's orientation to Latin America is actually much higher than the United States, much, much higher than the United States. The United States has a GDP that's 9-10 times greater than Canada. Canada's foreign investment in Latin America is a fourth of the United States. So it's actually, the orientation is actually much higher. So in some respects, you could say Latin American investment interests are, well, certainly as important, perhaps maybe even more important for Canadian companies than it is for American companies in that respect. But not only are the investments high, but not surprisingly, profits are high as well. And there's been some interesting research that's been done by different organizations on mining interests and profitability of Canadian companies in Latin America, as well as the mining industry more general in Latin America. So the Economic Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean has some interesting research showing that is a high rate of repatriation of profit from Latin America back to the countries where the investment originally comes from. The highest sector, mining. And of course, Canada dominates mining in Latin America as it does globally. So we did a bit of research on a few companies just to kind of get a taste for how much money Canadian mining companies are making. And so in 2012, Canadian operating mines in Latin America had a combined revenue of just under $20 billion. That's in 2012. And so we did a little research. We picked out the biggest gold mining companies, and what we did was we just tried to figure out how much profit they were making from their operating mines alone. And so we picked Barrick Gold, Yamana Gold, and Goldcorp. And we looked at their operating mines, 15 mines in total, that had been opened, that were currently open. This is a couple of years ago. So mining operations that were still being run. And so the oldest mine opened in 1998. By 2013, there were 15 mines. And they had to come over that time period, those 15 operating mines, from 1998 to 2011, three companies had a net profit of $15 billion in their operations. Their rate of profit, so what they earned over and above their costs, on average, 45%. So a good friend of mine who's wrote a book for Fernwood called Servant State, his name is Jeff McCormick with Tom Workman, has done research on profit rates for Canadian companies operating within Canada. And the average is something like 11.8% over that same time period. If you take away taxes and royalties, it's still 42.4% for those three companies operating alone. And so what's also interesting, important to remember, is the Canadian government and Canadian mining companies will say things like, well, we create jobs. And yes, we do. We spend some of our money on corporate social responsibility. I've taught a course on Canadian interests in the Global South, and I'll get my students to just go look up any Canadian mining company, and every single mining company will have a nice glossy thing on corporate social responsibility. And this has been completely debunked. Mining Watch has done a great job of debunking it. Other academic researchers have done a great job of debunking CSR, corporate social responsibility. But what you find is that it's a tiny, minuscule, marginal, almost irrelevant percentage of the profits that they actually spend on corporate social responsibility. It's almost meaningless relative to what they earn. But not only that, they use it in such a way to try to buy off communities. So if you're a community is not willing to play ball with the mining company, or not willing to make all the sacrifices that they want, you don't necessarily get the corporate social responsibility, such as it is. You get bought off, or you don't get bought off, right? And they may still open the mine anyways, and you don't get the corporate social responsibility. But then they bring in medical clinics that have to deal with all the poisons and toxins that you're absorbing in the community because of the practices of large-scale industrial mining. But what's also important to remember, too, because, again, the argument you often hear from the Canadian government is, well, we create jobs. Right? And so a couple of years ago, I was invited to testify to a subcommittee on international human rights at Parliament. And, of course, the back and forth with the conservative members of the committee was, well, we're talking about Honduras. And their argument was, well, you know, you're saying all these things about Honduras, but, you know, it would be worse if Canada wasn't there, because at least we're giving them jobs. What they actually don't say is that large-scale industrial mining is very capital-intensive, which is to say, it's heavy, like, the money that's spent in large-scale industrial mining is like auto companies, assembly manufacturers, or steel plants here. It's heavily, heavily weighted towards technology, machinery, and parts, not towards human labor. And in fact, as the Economic Commission on Latin America and the Caribbean showed in a recent report, mining is the worst job generator of all the major economic sectors in Latin America. It's the worst. So the jobs that are created are actually quite few relative to the people who are displaced. Most of the capital, if not all the capital in mining, for example, comes from abroad. And as the Economic Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean shows, that most of the profits that are earned, like a high percentage of the profits that are earned, actually flow back out of the region, back to countries like Canada. And once the mine is actually built, the construction phase is over, the new money or capital that flows into running the mine is actually quite small. That's what we found when we were doing the research on those three mining companies and their costs over that 1998 to 2013 or whatever it was, is that the actually new money from year to year is actually quite low. So once the mine is built, there's not a lot of new money coming in. So you have a mine that's built that displaces a lot of people. It's a really, really shitty job generator. Most of the profits actually leave and come back to Canada. And so what you actually create is what in the development studies, critical development studies literature, people refer to as an enclave economy. People will use that language around export processing zones like the maquiladoras in Mexico, is it's not really tied to the rest of the economy. And so what economists call forward linkages, that is the kind of ripple effect of the spending that goes on in that particular industry that's supposed to create jobs elsewhere down the line, doesn't actually really happen with mining. Because not only that, the people who are paid in mining aren't often paid very well. right? And most people don't get jobs, they get displaced. So it's actually, Canada promotes it. Canadian development agencies, Canadian government in general, mining companies, banks, they promote it as a development strategy. Even if they acknowledge the human rights abuses that go on in mining, they promote it as, which they don't normally do, but they promote it as a development strategy. But it's not. It's not a development strategy. It's not a development strategy any more than sweatshops are a development strategy, which they also promote as development strategy. When I was in Honduras, I thought maybe it'd be useful, so I set up an interview, it wasn't easy, with the Canadian ambassador. So we went down just after the coup in 2009. There was a military coup that overthrew the Honduran government, the left-leaning government. And so we're talking about Canadian mining interests and Canadian investment interests in Honduras. The biggest employer, private sector employer in Honduras is a Canadian company. It's called Gildan Activewear. It's based out of Montreal. They're the ones who just won the auction for American Apparel. And it's one of the largest t-shirt and sock manufacturers in the world. And they have a very big presence in Honduras. They also have a big presence in Haiti. The subcontractor that Gildan Activewear works with in Haiti, a man named Andy Apade, was a main force in the coup forces in Honduras. And so Gildan Activewear is active in Honduras, in Haiti, sorry, also active in Honduras. And so the Canadian ambassador said, well, have you ever been to Gildan Activewear's factory? One of their factories in Honduras. I said, no, I haven't. I tried to set up an interview. They wouldn't set up an interview. They wouldn't respond to my emails. I said, well, I've been there. You should see the lineups of people looking for work. I said, well, that doesn't necessarily mean they're a good employer. It just means people are desperate and looking for work. And he said, I've been in their cafeteria. I had lunch in there. This is a quote. The floor in that cafeteria is so clean, I could eat in there every day. He got promoted a few months later to head of the Latin American Caribbean desk at Foreign Affairs, which is also, it seems to be a byway station for ambassadors in Central America, because the former ambassador to Guatemala, James Lambert, also had that position as well, after promoting Canadian mining interest in Guatemala. Canadian interests, mining, banking, sweatshop manufacturing, I haven't mentioned dam building and hydroelectric projects, are very, very significant in the region. And so as a result, this is where Jeff would be much more useful than me, movement organizing is everywhere against Canadian interests. I mean, not just against Canadian interests, obviously, but certainly against Canadian interests, against Canadian mining projects, against Canadian sweatshop manufacturers. It's really, really significant. And that, what we call the dialectic of Canadian capitalist expansion on the one hand and resistance on the other, is what really animates Canadian foreign policy in the region. Like the stuff I talked about with the access to information documents and stuff. The reason why that's going on is because Canadian companies have significant interests in the region. They're one of the biggest foreign investing nations in the region, and the region, or significant parts of the region, don't really want Canadian companies there. And so Canada's response, the Canadian state's response, which is the response you would expect, there's what you would expect from an imperialist country, even not a superpower, but an imperialist country, is to not back away, but it's actually to do what you have to, diplomatically, politically, and sometimes in security, for a security strategy, do what you have to make sure Canadian interests are actually defended and advanced. But you see it in a number of different ways. Of course, you see it in trade agreements. Canada has been an aggressive proponent of trade agreements around the world, but in Latin America as well, under the Liberal government of Kachin, and of course under the Harper government. And those trade agreements, they're called trade agreements, but what really trade agreements are about is actually foreign investment. All trade agreements have foreign investment chapters in them, and in fact, Canadian trade negotiators, when Canada was signing a trade agreement with Honduras, said it was actually trade agreement is more about investment than it is about trade. And what's key about trade agreements is they really are consolidating private property rights of Canadian companies. And they do that by setting out rules, like legal obligations for governments to sign these agreements, and mechanisms to basically sue governments, the investor-state dispute settlement mechanisms, if governments are seen as not fulfilling their obligations under these treaties. And Canadian companies are aggressive users of this. You see it in Costa Rica, you see it in El Salvador, you see it elsewhere. So trade agreements are one big way in which they do that. Aid policy is another. We need to disabuse ourselves of the idea that Canadian aid is simply this benevolent thing. I'm not saying that has no part of it. And I'm not saying that anyone who works in Canadian aid for the government or for NGOs that receive money from the government are necessarily doing terrible things to people in the Global South. I don't mean that. But nevertheless, a significant amount of Canadian aid money, official Canadian aid money, is used to support the interests of Canadian investors. It just is. And sometimes people like Julien Fantino, when he was our Minister for International Cooperation, was very open about it. He said, aid is a paraphrase, the quote's in the book, but basically aid, one of the key goals is to make countries, I think the quote was, investment ready. And anything that's not about the free market is basically, it's backward. Like, this is the 21st century, folks. You know, it's all about free markets. And so aid money is used quite extensively. And there's a number of people who have done some interesting work on this. We talk about it in the book as well. And from 2002 to 2019, what was formerly called CETA, we used to be called CETA, had earmarked about $100 million to support the Canadian mining industry in Latin America. Most of that would come in the second decade of that 2002-2019, right? About $100 million. And of course, that includes what they call reform, right? So they try to dress it up, make it sound nicer, reform. But what they mean by reform and creating efficiencies, that's the language that they use, is basically to restructure natural resources sectors in Global South countries and like in Latin America, so that they are better able to support foreign mining investment. So creating new legal regimes, new investment laws, and so on. And so Canada has actively financed the rewriting of mining codes, such as in Colombia, such as in, more recently, in Honduras. It financed the Honduran mining code, or helped finance and helped influence the Honduran mining code, a very neoliberal mining code, after the 2009 military coup in Honduras.
That was an excerpt of Todd Gordon's talk at Octopus Books detailing Blood of Extraction. Todd Gordon is the author of Imperialist Canada and assistant professor of law and society at Wilfrid Laurier University. A special thanks goes to Octopus Books for making this presentation available to Rabble. Events at Octopus Books features like-minded authors who bring new and interesting ideas and books to the wider public. You can find more details about upcoming events and speakers by going to octopusbooks.ca. You've been listening to Rabble Book Lounge, a production of Rabble.ca. I'm Braden Alexander. Thanks for listening.